Council ready to proceed?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Please.
Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court, it's been a long time since I've had a chance to say that.
Welcome.
I'm sorry?
I said welcome.
Yes, thank you. I represent, my name is Thomas Watts, and I represent the petitioners Simin O and Myung Hui O. This case involves the purchase of stock. My clients purchased the stock of a corporation called Cliff Enterprises in May of 2001. Cliff Enterprises owned a little sundry store down in Chinatown. The transaction was brokered by the respondent, Connie Fong. Ms. Fong had a security interest in the corporation. And through that security interest, she controlled the seller to the transaction, whose name was Celia Battle. The Intermediate Court of Appeals found, and I quote, "The record supports the finding slash conclusion that Fong acted for herself and as an agent of Celia." My client's purchase of the stock of the corporation was premised upon certain income figures that were provided to them by the CPA for the corporation, a man named Harry Lee. These figures were provided at the direction of Connie Fong, and throughout my argument, with your permission, I'll refer to her that way, or Ms. Fong, Ms. Fong. Ms. Fong was aware that these figures were being provided to my clients, and she was aware that they would be relying upon those figures in making their decision whether to purchase and at what price.
Excuse me, Mr. Watts. Have you dropped the negligent misrepresentation claim?
Yes, in this court, Your Honor. I guess for all purposes, because it's been dismissed by the ICA.
So your two primary points, one, that this is a violation of 485, which allows you to collect damages for misrepresentation. Is that correct? That's one.
That is one of the points, yes.
The other one is the allegation that there should have been a disclosure by Mr. Kikuchi of the fact that some of the gross proceeds were, I guess, pumped up by the sale of illegal cigarettes. Is that correct?
Essentially correct, Your Honor, yes. Mr. Kikuchi had knowledge of the illegal cigarette sales. We have never contended that the misrepresent or the omission of material fact was a failure to state that the sales were inflated. Our position all along has been that the omission was the omission to state that there were, in fact, illegal cigarette sales going on. Once that fact had been disclosed to my clients, they could then conclude on their own that a portion of the income reported to them by the CPA was due to these illegal cigarette sales. I just want to make sure that that's clear, because it's a point that has been confused in the briefing. Again, our claim is that the omission was the omission to state that there were illegal cigarette sales going on. And both Mr. Kikuchi and Ms. Fong were aware of that fact. And they were aware of that fact because the owner of the corporation, Celia Battle, had been arrested by the state. And Mr. Kikuchi had been employed by Ms. Fong to deal with the state on that issue. And this occurred some 3 months prior to the sale of the stock to my clients. The sales figures were certainly material and relevant to the decision to purchase. And as I said, if the O's had known of the illegal cigarette sales, they could very well then have concluded that a portion of the income that was being reported to them resulted from these illegal sales. Absent that knowledge, they believed, as most people would believe, that the income resulted from legitimate sales. And in making their decision about whether or not to acquire the stock of this corporation, they assumed, rightly or wrongly, that they could probably equal or approximate the sales that had previously occurred.
There's no dispute that Gooch or Fong knew this.
There is no dispute about that, Your Honor.
The amounts were, give us an idea as to the amounts between the legal, if they were sold legally, and the fact that they were sold illegally. Well, what was the
illegal cigarette sales, we later determined, or I determined through research, accounted for a third to a half of the total sales that were going on. This is reflected in a number of sources. I've recited this in my opening brief. It's sort of the technical part of the brief, which might not draw much attention, but there, you can track the sales reports in the general excise tax returns for the corporation beginning from a period prior to the time that Celia assumed the ownership of the store, and then continuing after she sold to my clients. And you can, by tracking those general excise tax returns, you can see a trend. The income per month averaged $20,000 to $30,000 prior to the time Celia took over, and then suddenly jumped to $50,000 a month during the period of time she was in control of the corporation, and then dropped back down to $20,000 to $30,000 during the period of time that my clients were operating the store. From that, I conclude that the cigarette sales probably accounted for a third to a half of the income that was reported to my clients. Mr. Lee, who was the accountant, testified that Ms. Battle underreported her taxes by some $90,000 on these cigarettes. So clearly what she was doing was she was purchasing because she could. She had purchased cigarettes from foreign manufacturers, or from, in this case, Florida manufacturers. And the manufacturer can sell without having a tax. It's up to the state of Hawaii to apply the tax, and the tax is imposed at the level of the sale in Hawaii, not the sale in Florida. So Celia was buying cigarettes in Florida, not paying the tax on them to the state of Hawaii, and then discounting them. She could then sell them at a greatly discounted price to retailers, or to retail customers through her store.
Now, Ehrlich makes the point that the data the O's were given did not reflect this increase in sales. Is that correct?
Strictly, that's a correct statement in the sense that they only received data for 3 months. Yes, and those 3 months were during the inflated sale period. So they had no knowledge at the time they purchased of the prior period sales, which were considerably less.
How does the failure to return the security deposit work into your 485 claim?
It's really just a standalone claim, Your Honor. And
you drop that?
No, it was we won on that claim in the ICA, and so it's not before you. Mr. Kiyuchi, I'd like to focus for just a minute on Mr. Kiyuchi, if I might. This is part of the case that intrigues me the most, and I hope that it will also intrigue you, although how that plays out, I don't know. Kiyuchi was the attorney for neither of the parties to the transaction. He was the attorney for effectively what appeared to be a stranger to the transaction, but in fact, Ms. Fong controlled the seller. So Kiyuchi's client, Fong, had an interest in making sure that the transaction closed. Fong was sitting there with this sort of ephemeral asset that she controlled, this store, and she was owed a lot of money by somebody. And there were no candidates to pay her. So it was in her best interest, along come my clients, they have the funds to pay her at least $80,000 in cash and then a promise of paying the balance over time. And so it was important for Fong, because she was getting all of the proceeds from this sale, that the transaction close. And I believe, there's nobody has said this, but I believe that that's the reason that Mr. Kiyuchi became the escrow for this transaction, because that allowed Fong, through her attorney, to ensure that this transaction would close and that she would get her money. If there had been an independent escrow, that level of control obviously would have been lost.
How do you respond to the argument that the contract itself stated that Mr. Kiyuchi represented Mrs. Fong and that the O's could get their own attorneys?
There are two responses. First, three actually. First, that my clients don't read and understand English. And so this entire transaction, from their standpoint, was a matter of trust. And in my reply brief, if you had occasion to look at it concerning Connie Fong, I quoted the deposition testimony of my client where she said, basically, I did this transaction because I trusted Connie Fong and I didn't think that she would do anything underhanded. The second answer to your question is that exculpatory clauses can't, I believe, as a matter, or shouldn't be allowed to relieve an escrow agent of responsibility. You can't both agree to act as escrow and say, oh, by the way, even though I'm acting as escrow, I am not going to act as escrow. It presents such an ambiguous situation for people such as my clients that they could not possibly understand that. And the third point is that, actually, I guess I only have those 2 points. Lawyers like to talk in threes, but I could only come up with two. In just to sort of put the end on the story, after my clients had operated the store for about a year, a matter unrelated to our claims, but nonetheless important in the story, occurred, and it occurred because of the gray market sales. The liquor license came up for renewal, as they do each year. And the law is that in order to renew your liquor license, you have to show that you're current on your taxes. Well, at that point, for the first time, my clients discovered that Ms. Battle had failed to pay the taxes owed by Cliff Enterprises for the fiscal year that ended on May 31st of 2001, the fiscal year for the corporation. As a result, there was about $30,000 in taxes owing. They couldn't come up with the money. The liquor license was lost. Without the liquor license, the store was even less profitable. My clients gave up on the proposition of operating the store. They then, through me, demanded that their purchase price be refunded for violation of the securities laws and offered to convey the stock of the corporation to Ms. Fong in return. That offer was rejected, and that has led to the current litigation. I think that the state of Hawaii did such a wonderful job in their amicus brief on the issue of securities and market in the market case that I'm going to start, if I may, with respect to Mr. Kiyuchi. It is our position that the Intermediate Court of Appeals erred because they ruled that there's no duty owed. Forget about attorney-client, forget about the circumstances of this case. The ICA ruled that there's no duty owed by an escrow agent except what's in writing. And if it's not in instructions of some sort or an escrow agreement, the escrow agent has no duty. And that seems to me to be not only bad from a policy standpoint, it seems to me to be to contradict their decision in Kraft versus Bartholomew, and in which held that there was some sort of duty owed when an escrow agent has knowledge, active knowledge of potentially fraudulent information.
You make the argument that before the escrow agent or escrow has the duty to respond or to give information, that an inquiry has to be made. And they cite language out of
Kraft for that purpose. Yes. My response to that was the one I gave in my reply brief. In Kraft, you had the special circumstance where the party was inquiring about something they already knew something about. That is to say, they had submitted money into escrow and they were wondering what was going on. And in response to that inquiry, they got put off. They sort of got misled by the escrow company. In our case, how could we make an inquiry about something that we have no knowledge about? If there is a duty by an escrow agent to disclose something, and you can start at the top and say, well, an escrow agent has a duty at least to disclose absolute fraud that they can see coming down the pike. And you can sort of move down the scale from there and say, well, at some point, there's no spontaneous duty for an escrow agent to disclose anything below that point. Still, you would think that they would have, as long as we fall within that limit that I'm trying to ascribe here between absolute fraud and something less than that, as long as we fall in that range, there should be this duty to disclose without asking. Because you can't ask about something that you don't know about. People
what
are
the parameters of that duty.
Yes. I think if I were going to write an opinion, I would look to the way that fiduciary duty is described in other circumstances. And I think that your description of fiduciary duty in the Hahn case, H-A-N case, for real estate agents might be a good starting point for that sort of approach. I would not attempt to circumscribe this case, I don't think, presents the circumstance for an all-encompassing rule of law on the duty of an escrow agent. What I think it does present is the opportunity for the court to state affirmatively that there is a fiduciary duty owed by an escrow agent to the parties. And this fiduciary duty includes the duties that are normally associated with such fiduciary duties. And one of those is a duty of disclosure. And we're going to send this back to the lower courts to work out on the first go through what the level of that duty should be. I think at least that this case presents an opportunity to do that. I'd like to quote for you something that, now I'd like to focus on the fact that Mr. Kiyuchi is an attorney. Ron Mallon is the source on legal malpractice. He says the function and obligations of an escrow agent are inconsistent with those of an attorney. The escrow agent represents neither party and should be neutral. But an attorney owes an obligation of undivided loyalty to the client. So I'm also hoping that what comes out of this case is a statement from this court by way of direction to attorneys. Under what circumstances may an attorney properly act as an escrow? Now, we all do it to varying degrees in our practice. After having had this case, every time one of my friends, I hear about it, I call them up and I say, you know, you ought to think twice about acting as escrow in this case. Send it out to title guarantee, send it out to somebody who's independent. Save yourself a potential headache down the road. I would say that it should be the rare circumstance rather than the commonplace where an attorney acts as escrow. And I think that the touchstone is the use of the word escrow. If an attorney is party to a document in some fashion which describes him as an or her as an escrow, then I think that that is the point at which the attorney has given up his undivided loyalty to his client and falls into the circumstance cited by the Florida Supreme Court in Florida Bar versus Joy. Regardless of the escrow agent's other relationships or duties to the principal parties, when principal parties agree upon an escrow agent by undertaking to act as such, the escrow agent establishes a new legal relationship to the principal parties and by expressed agreement or implied in law agrees to certain basic inherent matters. The relationship established is that of principal and agent and involves the escrow agent being an agent of and owing a fiduciary duty to all of the principal parties.
Before your time runs out, I wanted to ask you, I'm not really persuaded by the memo from the consumer or insurance director. Hawaii Marketing or Hawaii Market Center said the reason the protection under 485 shouldn't be extended to, say, a small business or persons who are actively engaged in the management of the company is because that very fact enables them to safeguard their interests, whereas someone who just owns stock and is not involved in the management of the company would not have that kind of opportunity. So that seems to make sense. What's your response to that?
Well, there are several responses. First, I disagree that that's what the case says, Your Honor. I think what the case refers to as investment contracts rather than stock. And so I would agree with your analysis as it relates to investment contracts, but not stock. My second response is that if the entire reach of the Uniform Securities Act depends, the fraud provisions of the Uniform Securities Act, depends upon whether or not a majority of stock is conveyed or not, it will set up a situation where enforcement by both private parties and by the state becomes very difficult at the very least. Because the first part of the analysis in every transaction will have to be, was there a transfer of control? And what if 50% doesn't convey control? What if 60% is required to convey control, or 75%? Because 50% doesn't always convey control. What will happen is that the litigants and the courts will be involved in an exercise which detracts from the purpose of the act, which is to protect. I think my clients are a good example of people who needed protection. They purchased all of the stock of this company. Why should the, but can you, upon reading the record in this case, conclude that my clients just by virtue of the fact that they purchased a majority interest of the stock were sophisticated or knew what they were doing, or that for some reason the protections of the Securities Act should not apply to them?
Although the courts have not been flooded with these kinds of claims.
And the reason, I'm sorry, are you finished?
Well, I guess the point Hawaii Market Center was making was if they're actively involved in the management, then they always have, of course, the remedies at common law or civil law, whereas the 485 presents an additional type of remedy. And so the whole idea is that that kind of protection is not necessarily needed where people are involved in actively managing their own business.
I guess the question would be, at what point do you acquire the knowledge that someone actively involved in the business would be? If I understood your earlier question, you were referencing a situation. Let's suppose we have an initial public offering. That initial public offering is subject to the fraud provisions of the Act. Suppose that I, as a purchaser, purchase 51% of that initial public offering. I know nothing about the company other than what's been presented to me in the prospectus. And yet, even if they lie in the prospectus, I would have no claim under the Securities Act if you draw a magic line at 50%, anything over 50%. And that doesn't seem to me to be what was intended by the legislature.
Mr. Watts.
Yes, sir.
Am I missing something, or does this issue come down to a fairly simple question, namely whether stock in whatever quantity or proportion is a security or not?
That's the definitional approach, which I believe is the correct approach, Your Honor, yes. Go ahead.
Is there a question as to whether or not the lack of divulging the cigarette issue is fraud? Is there a dispute as to whether it's fraud or not fraud?
To rephrase it, Your Honor, the question would be, in the context of the securities laws, we didn't file a fraud claim, per se, common law fraud. And I won't go into the reasons for that. But under the securities laws, the test would be, was this a material fact? And so the question is it a material fact? And this is a jury trial, and this is a summary judgment decision. Our position is that issue of whether it's a material fact should have been decided by a jury at a trial, not by a judge in a summary judgment motion. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Well, there is. Can I just add? Well, there are a lot of issues involved in how you treat stock, right? I mean, if you look at the decisions, it's a question of should the federal approach apply, or the states, or are the feds interfering into the state situation? And you can take a definitional approach, or you can take an economic reality approach. Isn't that correct?
Well, I wouldn't phrase it that way. I ask you to only remember the issue of the initial public offering. The state.
You're talking about a public offering. Is that right?
Yes, but what's.
We don't have that situation here. We have what normally happens is just a private sale between two parties of a small business.
Mm-hmm. If you tried to. I suppose you could draw the line and you could say, well, in initial public offering, stock is stock, but in all other transactions, stock is not a security unless you purchase less than controlling interest. I suppose you could draw that line. I think that would be an unworkable line to draw. But yes, I understand. I was hoping to reserve a few minutes, so if you have nothing further, I'll sit down.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, David Gerlach for Connie Fong. I'd like to start first just to respond to who the O's are, because some of the statements that Mr. Watts made simply aren't supported by the record. He indicated they don't read or speak English. In fact, it was uncontroverted that Mrs. O obtained her citizenship and her driver's license in English, that they ran a business previous to this with a lease in English, and that they knew about lawyers because they had previously hired Mark Kawada to represent them in the previous business lease deal. The other issue is this cigarette issue seems to be a moving target. They never pled so-called illegal cigarette sales in their complaint. They first raised it in opposition to our motion for summary judgment after all of the major depositions had taken place. And they first claimed, at least that's how all of us on this side of the aisle understood it, that they were actually misled by these so-called false reports. And yet today, the argument is, well, no, we've never argued we were actually misled. It was a material omission. Well, I think the reason for this moving target is because the sales, what is undisputed, is that the so-called illegal sales ended in December of 2000, and the GET returns that were relied upon were those from February, March, and April of 2001. That's undisputed. They have no evidence that there were illegal sales at that time, and the leap that they have to make then is that somehow Ms. Battle is paying taxes on money she didn't make. People don't do that. So those are the uncontroverted facts. The primary concern that we have is that you may adopt Landreth, and I would respectfully ask you not to adopt Landreth. I think the old adage that if it's not broken, don't fix it really does apply here. Market Center has been the law of this jurisdiction for 36 years. Landreth was decided 22 years ago. And while they take different approaches to the definition of stock under similar securities acts, this is one of the beauties of our federalist system. States can do things differently than the federal government. That's what we have been doing.
So why Market Center speak to the definition of stock at all?
No, of course not. But it has been applied, in fact, to the definition of stock, I think, as Judge Chang recognized and as the Intermediate Court of Appeals recognized, as a practical matter, particularly in a sale of business situation, which is what we have here. The policy reasons underlying our Security Acts are to protect investors who don't have access to information, not to allow government to become a mother or a grandmother to private persons who can hire lawyers, negotiate their own transactions, and protect themselves with warranties and contracts, or walk away from the deal.
You make the point that this is basically a bulk sales, right? Something lawyers handle every day.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And not really a sale of stock. I mean, the parties here were really interested in transferring a business.
One of the central themes of Market Center was, let's not exalt form over substance. And this is nothing different than a sale of assets would be. And yet, if we're going to do a strict definitional term, a sale of stock would fall within the security laws, a sale of assets wouldn't. And it really is form without substance.
Are there remedies for in bulk sales for misrepresentations, et cetera?
I can't answer that specifically, Your Honor. I haven't reviewed that statute lately, but there certainly are common law remedies, which is what the O's raised.
Even if Landreth applied, would you still win?
Well, I think we would win because of the particular facts of this case, yes. And I think if there's a duty to disclose, maybe there's a duty to disclose something that's material. They haven't established that the cigarette sales that occurred prior to the documents they reviewed are material. But I think it would be a grave mistake to adopt Landreth, particularly in Hawaii. The backbone of our economy are mom-and-pop operations, close family corporations, and to impose the draconian, burden-shifting, anti-fraud provisions of this statute on these kinds of operations, particularly with our large immigrant population and so forth, I think if we're talking about floodgates of litigation, there you'll have it. It'll be good for us lawyers. It'll be very bad for our community.
Mom and pop situation is quickly disappearing.
It is, but I don't think that the small, closely held corporation is quickly disappearing, Your Honor. I think there are still lots of families who are doing business. Entrepreneurship is up. So to impose, these are protections that were imposed for a very good reason. People didn't have access to information. There's no reason to impose these kinds of obligations when people can access information, when it's an arm's length transaction.
Clarify this for me, I'm sorry.
Yes, sir.
Clarify this for me. You're saying that the cigarette sales, term to be the illegal sales, did not inflate the assessment, the value of the business, which misled your client. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. The evidence on the record is uncontroverted that the so-called illegal sales ended no later than December of 2000. Ms. Battle testified to that, and Deborah, another witness that's in the brief, testified to that. In fact, the other witness, Deborah Bakke, testified that it ended earlier in 2000. But the latest date is December 2000. They looked at GET returns for February, March, and April of 2001. So we've been scratching our heads, because no matter what may have happened before, what they relied on had nothing to do with the so-called illegal sales. And in some ways, we were really handicapped because they raised this issue so late in the game after discovery occurred without raising it in their complaint, as we believe they were required to under Rule 9. You know, Justice Stevens
said,
yes, sir.
You look at the characteristics of stock, is that correct?
I think what Landreth said, Your Honor, was we're going to take a literalist interpretation. Everybody, stock is stock, that's what the Congress said, and that's what we're going to say applies.
Well, and then they listed the characteristics of stock.
Yes, sir.
And if you applied those characteristics to the stock here, would they meet that those characteristics?
Well, I think they probably would. I think they probably would.
Would they meet the requirement that dividends be paid off of profit?
Well, that one, it may not. It may not. I didn't understand necessarily Landreth to be saying it had to meet each of those elements.
They list those factors.
I understand.
Would they meet the requirement that the stock be negotiable?
No, because it's a small corporation.
So if they wouldn't meet those factors listed in Landreth, then the stock here wouldn't satisfy the characteristics of stock as defined in Landreth.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
At the very least, is there a genuine issue of material fact in that regard?
In regard to whether?
Whether the stock in this case satisfied or met the rose to the level of a security for Landreth purposes?
Not in this record. Not in this record.
How do you answer the argument that if you place emphasis on management of the company, then you run into problems where the ownership of the stock would not be 100%, but something less than 100%. And I think Landreth, the majority says, well, you know, this will just generate a lot more cases. And I think that's one reason the Supreme Court went that way. They sort of indicate we don't need all these cases.
Well, but I think if...
So how do you deal with that problem under our situation?
I think that history has dealt with that, and we haven't simply had that circumstance arise in the 36 years that Market Center has been the law and has been, as a practical matter, applied to these kinds of sale of business transactions. It just hasn't happened. But boy, we can sure imagine when small businesses fail, as they do every day, that the person who failed is going to start looking at what small matter wasn't disclosed to them by the seller and come after the seller for recompense, which is precisely what we believe happened here.
Well, they could do that anyway, right?
They can do it under the common law theory, but the grounds to do it under the Securities Act are so much broader and so much more draconian. The burden is really then on the seller. And that, I think, is the great danger that awaits us if we adopted Landreth. I think Justice Stevens made many of these same arguments in his dissent in Landreth, essentially identifying what the policy purposes were for the Securities Acts, and that basically it was to protect those without access to information, not those in a position to get it. I would remind this honorable court that our securities laws began as a creature of state law, not federal law. Congress has refused to preempt state laws with federal law, so there's a good reason to have differences in state versus federal law, even regarding the definition of a stock. This is simply a case where we've had an arm's length transaction. The parties negotiated. The O's knew a lawyer, had a lawyer, had access to a lawyer, signed documents, bought a business as is, and it failed. That happens in America. But Mrs. Fong was not the guarantor of their success, and we would respectfully ask you to dismiss the application for cert, to hold that the ICA decided this case properly, and to continue Market Center as the existing law in this state, even as it applies to the sale of business. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices. I'm Keith Hiraoka, and I represent Keith Kiyuchi. The Chief Justice asked whether there was a dispute about what Keith Kiyuchi knew. And Mr. Watts stated that he didn't believe there was a dispute. I think that there was not a dispute that Keith Kiyuchi knew that Celia Battle had been arrested for illegal cigarette sales, but there certainly was a dispute about whether Keith knew whether it was material or not to the transaction, whether there had or had not been illegal cigarette sales. But that's not a dispute that created a genuine issue of material fact below. Because that begs the question, even if Mr. Kiyuchi knew everything that the plaintiffs allege he knew, did he have a duty to disclose?
Mr. Hiraoka, I believe that Mr. Kiyuchi testified in his deposition, among other things, that, quote, if we had any idea, she, Celia, was going to be charged or had been charged in relation to the illegal sales of cigarettes, we would have disclosed that. Why? Why disclose if she's going to be charged with an offense, but not disclose if she isn't?
Your Honor, I don't know that that's exactly what Mr. Kiyuchi said, but in response to your question, I think that if...
Well, his statement was, I mean, what was disclosed was the sale Celia made to a minor, and she was going to be responsible for that. So I think at that point, if we had any idea she was going to be charged or had been charged in connection with the cigarettes, we would have disclosed that. That's what he said.
Well, Your Honor, the sale to the minor could have an impact on the corporation's liquor license. And with the cigarette sale, if she was actually charged, then that would have raised, not a presumption, but it would have meant that there was probable cause to believe a crime had been committed. Your Honor, when Mr. Kiyuchi says we in the deposition, it's my submission that he was referring to we, meaning his client, Connie Fong. Mr. Kiyuchi, and there's no, Mr. Watts agreed, Mr. Kiyuchi did not represent either Celia Battle or either of the O's. So when I think Mr. Kiyuchi was being deposed, he was testifying about what the duty of disclosure might have been under certain circumstances for his client, or perhaps for Ms. Battle, but not for him personally, because his duty as escrow was to execute the written instructions given to him by the parties to the transaction. And that's why, Your Honor, I don't believe that there's a conflict that arises when an attorney for a party to a transaction or for a third party to a transaction who may have an interest in the transaction serves as escrow, because the parameters of the escrow's duty, as can be gathered from the case law that's cited in the briefs, is number one, to follow the written instructions, and number two, to respond to inquiries by the parties to the escrowed transaction. And in the cases in which attorneys have been found liable for breaching a duty as an escrow, those are cases where the attorneys have mishandled the money, transferred the money in escrow to their spouse's checking account, or have not seen that the funds in the certificate of deposit were rolled over so that the CD was valueless as a security in the escrow. Those all...
An escrow agent, excuse me, have fiduciary duties?
Yes.
What are those?
The fiduciary duties are to follow the instructions of the parties, even if it's to the escrow agent's detriment. For example, Your Honor, if a escrow holder has an independent claim for fees or maybe an outstanding judgment against one of the parties to the escrow couldn't then garnish himself or herself and take the money that's owed under the terms of the escrow agreement to the other party. I submit what the escrow's fiduciary duty there is to follow the escrow instructions, and then the escrow, acting as a judgment creditor or as in another capacity, can then go against that party after the escrow has been terminated. So when we speak of fiduciary duty in the terms of escrow, I don't believe that it's broad enough to encompass what the plaintiffs in this case try to characterize the duty as, escrow having an affirmative duty to conduct due diligence on behalf of the parties, both parties, or all parties to the transaction. That would be impracticable for any escrow to conduct. It would require an escrow to make an independent determination of what facts a party may consider to be material. And there's
no... Is there an inherent conflict between being an attorney for one of the parties? Well, was Ms. Fong a party to this escrow?
She was not.
Okay. She was certainly an interested party.
She was an interested party.
The monies were to be paid out of escrow to her?
Yes.
So is it an inherent conflict for escrow to be escrow and at the same time to represent a party interested in the funds in escrow?
Under the facts of this case, no, Your Honor. I believe that there could be potential conflicts that arise, and I agree that an attorney should consider the potential conflicts before agreeing to serve as escrow in a transaction in which that attorney's client either is a party or has an interest. However, in what Mr. Kiyuchi did in this case, I think satisfied and eliminated those potential conflicts. Mr. Kiyuchi disclosed in the transaction documents, which also served as the escrow instructions, who his client was. He affirmatively stated who he did not represent. And Mr. Kiyuchi's client consented to his involvement by agreeing to the escrow instructions so that Mr. Kiyuchi wasn't doing anything that his client didn't authorize him to do. And so in this, under the facts of this case, Your Honor, there was no conflict of interest. There was no, Mr. Kiyuchi's loyalty wasn't divided.
Well, there may have been, but are you saying that by not objecting, the parties agree or waive their objections to Mr. Kiyuchi being both attorney for Ms. Fong and escrow?
Well, they certainly agreed to have Mr. Kiyuchi act as escrow with the actual knowledge, because it was in the documents that everyone signed, that he was Ms. Fong's attorney and he was not Ms. Battle's attorney or the attorney for either of the O's. So yes, Your Honor. And again, I don't believe we reach the question of whether there was a conflict to be waived or whether there was a waiver, because in fact there was no conflict.
Well, I understand that's your position.
Yeah. I wanted to point out the difference between an escrow in a situation like this that doesn't involve a transaction involving real property or title to real property, and an escrow that most people think of when they hear the term, something like title guarantee, doing a closing on the sale of a home. An escrow in that case does much more than receive documents and disburse money. The escrow in that case is responsible for recording documents at the Bureau of Conveyance. Oftentimes, either the escrow or a related company issues a policy of title insurance. So I don't think that it's useful or practical to lump all different types of escrow transactions into one cookie cutter category. And that's why in the briefs, I made the distinction between the statute governing escrow companies not applying in this case, because Mr. Kiyuchi wasn't a corporation and the transaction didn't involve title to real property. But I think factually that's an important distinction to be made. And if the court, and why I think the court should refrain from attempting to formulate a blanket definition or a blanket parameters for duties of an escrow company, other than strictly abiding by the escrow instructions signed by the parties. Unless the court has further questions, I don't have any other argument. Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Watts have?
It'll be real quick. With respect to this factual issue of when did the illegal cigarette sales stop, I remind you that Celia Battle was arrested in April of 2001 for selling illegal cigarettes out of her store. So she was still selling illegal cigarettes in April of 2001. Also, counsel has misquoted the deposition transcript. I have it in front of me. Rather than read it to you in my brief time remaining, I ask leave to draw your attention to it after the argument is finished by citation to the record, if with the court's permission. May I have that permission? Thank you. Finally, with respect to Justice Levinson's point about if it's material at one point, what makes it material? Why is it not material for all purposes at that point? And that emphasizes exactly what happened in this case. Kiyuchi, in the deposition testimony read by Justice Levinson, effectively said, yes, the sale of illegal cigarettes was material, but only if she's charged. Well, the truth of the matter was she was charged. It's just that she wasn't charged until a year later. So This is a situation where it became material in Mr. Gerlach's or Mr. Kiyuchi's position only after the fact. That can't be right. If it's material, it's material for all purposes. Thank you very much.
Court will take this matter under advisement.
Thank you.